This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll hear from one of the lawmakers leading an effort to create a legal definition of consent in Indiana. We're talking about current laws around rape and consent in Indiana and a push at the State House to create a legal definition of consent. We're joined now by Republican House Representative Sharon Nagel, state legislator for District 13. Representative Nagel, what are current laws around rape and consent in Indiana?
So what current law is easily defined when a person is compelled by force or imminent threat of force in regards to rape. And it also covers specific scenarios if somebody's incapacitated or doesn't have the ability because of the mentally deficient to be able to consent to intercourse. Specifically what it's lacking and that other states have also recognized is consent. It does not clearly state what consent means. It is maybe implied or as some would say that it's not needed because we have case law that supports what consent would mean. And then also what it's lacking is when someone plays intentionally induces concealment of their identity. And we know of some scenarios where that's occurred, specifically occurs in more communal type settings, but rare as it is, it still is rape and it's not defined within our statute.
And can you explain that a little bit? Someone concealing their identity, how does that fit in?
So we actually had a situation at Purdue where a young woman was in her consenting partner's bed and the partner had left the room and an individual knowing that the consenting partner had left the room slipped in and was aware that the victim had no idea that that wasn't her boyfriend until farther into the act when she realized it wasn't him. And the individual was then confronted and then eventually she filed a case against him. Prosecutors filed a case, but they weren't able to prosecute based on the way our current statute is that it just didn't cover exactly what had happened in her scenario. So this again has also been defined in other states' statute. So we're just trying to mirror kind of up to date what can happen and making sure it is covered within our Indiana statute.
It sounds like if something happens to somebody, they really have nothing to protect them at this moment. I mean, just I'm thinking about this case that you just mentioned. There were no repercussions for this person,
right? Because it's one, his identity was concealed. She truly thought it was her normal consenting partner, and it was very a very cruel act on that person, the perpetrator, and our current code just doesn't cover that circumstance. While it is a rare circumstance, we just felt strongly that it needs to be covered. And we're not the only state that has that kind of language in there. Obviously, I feel like, there are two areas in which our rape statute's lacking. One is, clearly stating what consent can be, and then clearly stating this example of concealment. The struggle is that there's always case law that, yes, supports these scenarios, but I believe it just isn't clear and concise to a jury who is always the trier of facts. So I think it's just really important that we clearly state it within our statute.
Can you talk about the bill you authored, House Bill 1079, and how it would add to the laws we have in place right now?
So 1079, which passed overwhelmingly out of the committee and then, of course, overwhelmingly out of the House, is now heading over to the Senate. And this bill, after considerable discussion on what the definition of consent should be, after going through a summer study, we worked really hard with the Indiana Association of Prosecutors, trying to come up with the concise language that we need to define. So in Section 5 of the statute, we provided a clear definition of consent. And then we also defined specifically the rare situation, narrowed it down to, you know, rape by fraud, when someone is deceiving themselves as the victim's normal consensual partner. So those are the basically two sentences we added to the statute, which to me then rounds out our entire rape code statute to really cover all the specific scenarios. And consent specifically is stated that the other person has expressed a lack of consent through words or conduct to sexual intercourse or other sexual conduct. I think it's clear that it's, you know, sometimes the physical differences between a man and a woman can be so significant that a physical fight isn't even possible. Someone can be pinned down and or someone can be, you know, trying to pull their clothes back on. So, you know, that's a conduct. I mean, there are just those scenarios where force wasn't actually part of it. It was fear. So we just really have to make sure that we are very clear on how we describe this to the jury. And my concern is that right now it's inconsistent across the state from courtroom to courtroom, and how this case law is presented by prosecutors or presented via the judge on direction. And the concern is that it's not as clear and concise. It's confusing more confusing to the jury. We heard some examples, a summer study where a juror asked the judge, can you define consent? And the judge's response was, just use your own good judgment. And so that's the kind of inconsistency I want to eliminate. I want to make sure that it is in our state statute and clearly explains what consent is through words or conduct.
What prompted you to write this bill in the first place? I know there was essentially the same bill last year, something similar, but it didn't get past the Senate. So what prompted you to do this one?
So sometimes we know when trying to pass legislation, it does take a couple of sessions to actually get it through and get everybody on board on what the intentions are. Last session, this is identical language as last session. And again, you know, passed overwhelmingly out of the House again. And this time around, going to the Senate, we are really working hard on trying to get everyone on the same page of what the intent behind this language is. The Senate chair chose not to have a vote on it. The timing was a little stressful because it was the last bill of the last possible committee hearing, and we just kind of ran out of time. But I'm hoping this time around we will have a little bit more of a head start. And I have a team that I'm trying to develop around this bill and support that can work with the Senate and get the support that we need this time around.
Have you heard from folks who are opposed to this bill, or is it pretty resoundingly folks are supporting it?
So who's against it is the defense attorneys, and particularly they feel strongly about the utilization of case law. They feel that our current statute is sufficient and that the purpose of case law is to be able to address these particular issues. I, on the other hand, feel that that is not sufficient, nor do the Indiana Association of Prosecutors feel that way. So it's not unusual that the Public Defenders Association versus the Prosecutors Association do not agree on some of these particular criminal code issues. But that's who would be against it, and that's who actually spoke in committee against it. And it's not unusual that if an attorney is on practices on the public defender side, tends to view this differently. So that's the typical opposition I deal with.
Is it a concern at all that survivors will not come forward if they feel like these laws are not strong enough?
And that's, of course, always presented in committee. And I'm hoping that this time around, we will have enough pressure and enough time to have plenty of testimony to reinforce that. And House, obviously, we don't have that difficulty. It seems to be on the Senate side. So this time around, we're hoping to jumpstart that.
Do you know of any neighboring states that have legal definitions of consent? Are you looking to any of them for this bill?
Well, the specific state that we actually modeled after, was the language was from Utah, another fairly conservative state. So it's, you know, each state is different, but that was the one that I really kind of looked at their language and working with the Indiana Association of Prosecutors, a specific attorney that's really involved with all the sex crime criminal code. It was quite helpful and helping me, you know, develop that language and figure out what would work best in our statute. Because everyone's statutes are designed differently, it's not always comparing apples to apples.
Even with support and maybe this time around having more of a chance, do you think there's anything that could make it difficult for the bill to pass this year?
You know, there is a tremendous amount of power when you're a chair of a committee, and a chair committee can choose to pass or not pass a bill. So that is really the funnel we have to get through.
And you just heard our conversation with Representative Sharon Nagel about a lawmaker's leading an effort to create a legal definition of consent in Indiana. When we come back, we will learn about how Indiana fits into what some are calling the Great Resignation. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. A reminder, this show is not live. I'm Miriam Soap, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're talking about the impact the pandemic has had and continues to have on workers in Indiana. We're joined now by Beau Ballou, Professor Emeritus of Rural and Regional Development at the Department of Agricultural Economics and the Purdue Center for Regional Development. Welcome, Beau.
Good afternoon. Happy to be with you.
You recently looked into data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics for a study on what's been called the Great Resignation. What were you hoping to learn?
Well, you know, you probably remember last fall, around September or so, there was a big brouhaha in the media about the Great Resignation, about the number of people who were quitting their jobs. And that really came to the forefront when the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics was released in September. It showed that about 4.3 million people left their jobs in September, and that was the highest ever recorded. So that really got a lot of people thinking, think tanks, economists, state, federal government people, whatnot, really began to hone in on that. And then it got a little bit better in October, 4.1 million, went up to 4.5 million, actually exceeding the highest rate that was recorded in September. So all that began to really make me think, okay, this is a really big issue nationally. How are we doing in Indiana? Because, you know, Indiana is not necessarily a barometer of what's happening nationally and vice versa. So I want to see how we're doing with respect to the very same things that the Bureau of Labor Statistics was looking at. And as you probably know, that report is called a Job Openings and Labor Turnover Study, and it's done every month, and it really provides some valuable information about the labor force in each of our states in the country.
What did you find after studying these changes in Indiana, like the most significant trends you saw happening here?
Yes, sure. What I could probably do is, before I discuss that, let me tell you a little bit about what we call the JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover. It really looks at three major things. One, how many job openings are there? How many people have we hired in a given month? And how many people have separated from their jobs? And that separation could be due to, one, that they were laid off or discharged from their work involuntarily. They left voluntarily by quitting. Or the third thing is that their job is that they left because they had a disability or they, in some cases, unfortunately, people have passed away. So there are different ways to look at this. What we found out in my first study I did about a week or so ago that got released was really looking only at the last 5 or 6 months of 2021. This is the latest data that were available. What we saw was job openings were really accelerating. But at the same time, job openings, job hires were declining. So we were less able to find the talent we needed to fill the accelerating number of job openings. And what aggravated that situation was the fact that so many people in the state, like the nation, were quitting their jobs, were leaving their current employers.
I think, you know, there's been discussion about, you know, why folks were leaving in a variety of theories. Is there anything that you found? I mean, I know you mentioned there's these different areas from being laid off to voluntarily leaving to disability as reasons people might leave. Was there anything else more specific than that you were able to obtain?
Well, what we tried, we weren't able personally to do a survey of our workforce and find out what is forcing you, why you're leaving. But what we do know from a number of studies that have been done already, there are a number of factors that are, you know, propelling people to quit their jobs. And this would apply to Indiana as well. There's just no doubt about it. One is that the pandemic has really got a lot of people to think twice about their current job. And as you know, we have so many job openings, you know, in the state, something in the neighborhood of about 240,000 jobs as of the last date available in November. What we found is that a lot of people are saying, you know, this is a great opportunity for me to change jobs. I've not been happy in my job, but it's not providing me the right compensation or benefits. So I want to go ahead and try to do that now when the openings are so much larger in number than they have been in the past. So that's one thing. People are leaving because they're not happy in their current job and see the opportunity to get better benefits, better pay, and whatnot. The other thing really gets to what Roberto spoke about earlier. There's a number of people who say, you know, I've really have had to work remotely for the last several months, and I've been productive. I've been able to have work-life balance, and I don't really want to go back to my job in the shop or in the office, whatever job they had before, in the office situation. So they're looking for a job that may accommodate that. Some employers have been willing to do that to provide, as Roberto said, a hybrid situation, some time in the office, some time at home. And those who are not willing to do that are, you know, insisting that they come back to work. Some of those people are leaving. Say, I don't want to take the risk with the pandemic. I just want to be able to really continue to work on a hybrid basis or full-time remotely. And there are a number of other factors as well. You know, burnout, as you probably know, as people have left their jobs, the burden of maintaining the job has really required less people to do a lot more. And mm-hmm. people have been burned out and said, I can't do this anymore. I'm stressed out. I have mental health issues because of this. So again, a lot of factors at play here with regard to why people are leaving their jobs here in Indiana.
Yeah, and I'm thinking in regards to burnout, I think that was kind of the tipping point, you know, right before the pandemic. I'm thinking even my own situation was like, you feel burnout, you want to leave the career you're in. And then the pandemic just had you really magnify your situation and be like, yeah, is it really worth the stress?
Absolutely. And as you know, a lot of, even in two couple families, two individuals married, or even the single parent families, in particular, single parent families, you don't know from day to day if your child is going to be home because of a pandemic problem at school. Their life is really a struggle because they don't know from the day to day if they have to stay home to take care of their child who may be sick or has to do e-learning. Those ups and downs for parents has been a tremendous burden on them. And some parents have decided, we just can't take this anymore. Somebody has to stay home to be able to make this work.
Yeah. And did you find anything that surprised you when you were looking at this data for here in Indiana?
Yeah, what I did, the initial study I did was actually, like I said, the last few months of 2021. I said, I wonder if this pattern would hold up. If we went all the way back to January 2020, prior to the initial pandemic. And what we found was that in March and April of 2020, we saw a lot of people who were separated from the job. We're talking about thousands and thousands of people in Indiana. And the major reason was because employers were letting them go. They were laying off or discharging, you know, firing them, just because, as you know, at that time, there's so much going on that employers just they couldn't keep their doors open. People had to work remotely, and some companies just could not accommodate that given what they produce or the services they provide, it can't be done remotely. So there's a tremendous decline in the number of people who are working, and the major culprit was people who were laid off or were discharged from their employment. That now is completely different. What we find now is that the issue is not so much people who are being let go involuntarily, it's people who are leaving their jobs voluntarily. So what we see is a major decline in job openings early on in 2020, a resurgence, and now the job openings in the state have really, really rebounded. Unfortunately, we don't have enough people to fill them. Now, we have, like I said earlier, 240,000 jobs opened in Indiana as of November, the latest data that are available. We have about 84,000 people who are unemployed, 88,000 actually people unemployed in the state. We don't even have enough people unemployed who can actually fill those jobs if they had the skills needed to fill them.
Well, with regards to these jobs that are the 240,000 jobs that are open right now, I mean, are they a certain skill set that's needed? Because somebody might argue, yes, well, they can be open, but, you know, they're not going to be able to fill them.
And that's exactly right, because if you look at where has there been major depletion in jobs, where have people left? They tend to be jobs that don't necessarily pay the highest wages or are such where people have to be near a number of other people. You know, the closeness, the kind of the risk of maybe being subjected to the pandemic, to the Omicron or whatever the latest pandemic may be. So what we've seen declines in, the major declines, and this includes these in Indiana, obviously restaurants, bars, these hotels, retail establishments, healthcare workers. We've seen a major burnout on the part of healthcare workers who are leaving work, leaving their jobs because of just the stresses they've had to deal with the last several months. Even the educational services are seeing a decline because people who are involved in teaching at the elementary level, middle school, high school, they're also facing a lot of challenges in terms of how do you teach kids with this constant interruption in the teaching, in the instructional level. Child care workers, major burnout in child care workers, and those don't pay really high wages. Then we see a lot of also with regard to the logistics, transportation, warehousing. Those all happen to be jobs, by the way, that are in pretty large numbers in Indiana. The very sectors that are being really impacted by the pandemic, we have a high number of jobs in Indiana that fall into those categories.
If you're listening live right now, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That number, again, is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Beau Beaulieu, Professor Emeritus of Rural and Regional Development in the Department of Agricultural Economics and the Purdue Center for Regional Development. Beau, are there any gaps with the data that you've been looking at where you wish there was more information available?
Yes, you know, the problem with the JOLTS data is really based on a survey every month of about 16,000 establishments. These are all non-farm establishments. Now, as I just shared with you, there are certain sectors, different industries that are really being negatively impacted by the pandemic or by the people quitting their jobs. What we don't have is we don't have the data at the Indiana level because the survey sample is not sufficient to allow us to have those kind of data at the Indiana level. So what I'm sharing with you is really kind of general observations that we're seeing nationally with the hope that these may be applicable to the state of Indiana. I wish we had that more granular data. Our office, PCRD, Purdue Center for Regional Development, we're trying to find different ways to be able to dig into that information by looking at different data sources that come out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the Bureau of Economic Analysis. We're just trying to get a better handle on what data might help us paint the picture more accurately for our state.
Is there a reason why it's not available as much for the state level versus a national level?
Yeah, again, largely because the job openings and labor turnover survey is limited in terms of when you have 16,000 establishments and that's kind of a representation of all businesses across the country, then clearly there's no way that a whatever portion may have come from Indiana will be a sufficient size to be able to make accurate estimates of what's happening in our state. So that's the problem right there. I guess it probably one of the other things that maybe is a good, maybe a good sign perhaps, is that we've had a number of business formations in the state post-pandemic. When the pandemic hit, we saw a lot of people who decided to become self-employed and decided this may be a good option for me at this point. So we've seen a big, big surge over the last year, maybe probably in excess of about close to 30% growth in business formation. So that's been maybe a plus. But the other issue is how do we make sure that we were able to keep them alive and thrive during this difficult time?
There's been a nickname mentioned for this period of time where folks are leaving called the Great Resignation. Do you think that's an accurate representation of what's been happening?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of people debating that very issue. And they say, well, it's not really a great resignation because people are not leaving the job. They're just changing jobs, a good number of them. So some have argued it's more the great reshuffle or the great re-reckoning or the great, what I like to call the reshifting. People are just reshifting their jobs. They're reshifting their priorities and their career pathways. So that's what I think is probably a more accurate estimate or more accurate reflection of what's really, really happening out there. So, yeah, you're right. Great resignation is not really capturing that correctly.
Earlier when we spoke with Roberto, we mentioned that digitization and changing things in that sense were happening before the pandemic, but the pandemic accelerated that. Are you seeing that similar sort of trajectory with what's happening with jobs?
You know, we don't, as Roberto indicated, we don't really have the data, though there have been studies that would seem to indicate that the kinds of jobs that are being really, really hard to fill are ones that don't necessarily pay high wages, can't get too many people to apply. And just think of your own experience when you now go into a restaurant or if you go into, you know, go into a fast food place. Now it's all kiosks. You see this. They're now going with automation. They're trying to find new ways to fill in for jobs that simply can't be filled by human beings. So that's one of the manufacturing, of course, is going that route because it's hard to find people. We're talking about the possibility of having, you know, driverless transportations for shipping, and, you know, like basically truckers. The whole trucking industry is really, really hard pressed to find workers. So what are they thinking about? How do we automate it? How do we help move goods and services without having a human being driving it? Scares the holy living daylight out of me to think I'd be going down I-65 and seeing a driverless a semi going down the road. But that may very well be the reality of the future. So you see what the jobs are really, really getting hard to fill, they're now going to automation. You probably have heard about hotels that are now going to robots to be able to go into a room and change the sheets and clean up the room. It's because those are really, really hard jobs to replace right now because people are leaving and you can't find a replacement.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if this would have happened anyway if we hadn't hit this pandemic. Was it a matter of time or is this just the way it is?
You know, it's like anything else. Whenever you have a situation where the economy is really thriving in terms of job openings, we're not quite where we were prior to the pandemic. We're still short in terms of how many jobs to make up to be able to be equal to what we've had before. But we're really, really making some big strides. What we have is we have less people available to us. There's been some studies done that the long-term workforce is really, really changing. The demographics point to less number of people who are of prime working age, those 16 to 24, those 25 to 44. Those are demographic groups that are shrinking. The demographic group that's growing is those 55 and over. And those happen to be people who are, some of them have retired at a higher rate through the pandemic. But the argument is those people are likely to at least consider coming back to work. These studies show that we're going to have an increasing number of people who are senior citizens who are going to stay in the workforce because, you know, health, advances in health and whatnot, they can work longer. And so we can't forget that the older generation, the older workers are really, they're prime candidates to continue working for us.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back for our final segment, we'll find out how hospital nurses across Indiana are being impacted by the Omicron surge. If you want to get in touch with us, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. A reminder, this show is not live. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. For our final segment, we'll find out how hospital nurses across Indiana are being impacted by the Omicron surge. A reminder, this show is not live, but you can always get in touch with us by reaching out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leaving us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm curious, Rachel, have you heard from patients or families that are now noticing this, that are like, we had no idea this was going on?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I talk to patients and families when I'm around in the hospital, as well as when I talk to the general public, they really have, they didn't really understand how this has impacted people's ability to get care and the timeliness of care, and just that we've had to alter what we consider our standard of care. And, you know, it is just overwhelming to think about having to alter the standard of care because we don't have the necessary resources. And the general public and patients and families, they are surprised when you tell them, well, it's not necessarily that just because you're not a COVID patient doesn't mean that it doesn't impact everyone. This just isn't for COVID patients. This is for someone experiencing a stroke, an MI, you know, time-sensitive diagnoses that can change their outcomes, you know, depending on how quickly you can get to them. It impacts everyone that's coming to us for care, not just for those seeking care for COVID. But COVID, definitely, I can tell you right now, that would be approximately, you know, 30 to 40 less patients in my building without COVID. And I can tell you the majority of those are unvaccinated individuals. And if I didn't have them in the hospital, would it definitely help open up staffed beds? It would help open up some staffed beds to get people taken care of in a more timely manner when we talk about the availability of staff beds across the country and in our state. But it really does talk to, even if we do see these COVID numbers go down, just as Amy said, we're still going to have staffing issues. And it's going to take us not only 5, 10, it's going to take us several years to return to a baseline. And then will we ever be able to recover the number of healthcare workers that have left the bedside? But yes, families and patients are really surprised. And then when you explain, they're like, wow, thank you for explaining that to me. I really understand now what the healthcare landscape looks like.
I wonder if part of it is, you know, just always thinking that healthcare is there for us. Maybe having sort of this entitlement mentality where we're like, if we get sick, we're going to go to the hospital and we'll be taken care of, and not realizing there's a lot more to it than that.
Right. And I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, we are so fortunate in the U.S. that we have great healthcare and that we have just unbelievable technologies. But at the end of the day, if we don't have those qualified professionals to be able to provide the care and to use the technologies that we have today to ensure a healthy life, then we can't provide that care anymore. And we're so fortunate in our country. And this is the first time I think people have really seen what can happen when that infrastructure starts to decline or degrade because of just so much pressure that's been placed upon it. So it definitely is, I think, an eye opener.
Amy, does the CDC quarantine guidelines that came out that shortened the amount to 5 days, does that help at all with staffing?
It does help somewhat. However, for healthcare organizations, I think this entire time, the CDC has given some leniency in that they understand that when you're caring for COVID positive patients and you're COVID positive, that there can be some exceptions made for allowing staff members to come back early. However, I don't know about Rachel. I would say her organization is probably the same. But when my nurses get COVID, they don't feel well. and they're not able to come back and work. So there are times, I think, when you have, you know, just a few small symptoms and they feel, people feel like working. But for the majority, when you get sick and you have a fever, you're not going to feel like you can come back and work. And what I have experienced even in the past several weeks is that several of my team members, while the 5 days, decreasing to the 5 days is fantastic, the symptoms tend to linger a bit. So I have not been getting 100% of my nurses back at the 5 day mark because they just don't feel well. So then we are having to try to, you know, piece together for an extended, a longer extension on that 5 days while those individuals have been out. And while, you know, we think, oh, healthcare will always be there, I think you're somewhat right in that we've maybe been a little bit spoiled to think that. But the truth is that my nurses are out in the community and they're being exposed to COVID just like every other person. So when you look at the positivity rates, you have to include that in the, that's a positivity rate for nurses as well, because they are part of the general population. And when you take an additional that number of nurses out of the mix, then you do have to change the way you think about how many patients you're going to be able to have on each unit and what do my staffed beds look like.
Rachel, how has that been for you?
Just like Amy said, you know, we're not necessarily seeing many nurses that are able to come back symptom-free, you know, in that five-day timeframe. And those nurses work with very high risk patients at times. So we have to really ensure that we're being really careful. And so, you know, it's our job to keep those patients safe and really to ensure that our nurses are getting the full recovery they need. So we're using it on a case by case basis. It's not across the board. Oh yeah, I can bring a nurse back in 5 days because we really have to, you know, tune in to what's best for our patients and our staff. And, you know, that 5 day may not be it. And so we've taken a really more of a case by case basis on what we're seeing with that individual, because yes, we can't afford for them to be out sick, but at the same time, we have to also maintain the quality and safety in our building. And so it's really a fine line, and it's not really a solid answer to staffing issues. And you have to think too, with what Amy mentioned of not only not having enough nurses, but when you have a percentage of them out with COVID, it may not just be them. Their children are out. Now their daycares are closed. They don't have daycare. And so it's many things that impact our nursing staff that cause us to have these shortages. And so it really is compounded, you know, when we have high positivity rates that we're experiencing.
And I'll jump in real quick to talk just a little bit about the daycare. And I think a lot of places are getting very creative. When schools shut down in the areas, we had just last week, several schools in our area had to shut down because of the positivity rate, because of the number of faculty and students that were out of school. What we did is we opened Clubhouse Schneck, and we said, if your kids aren't in school and we need you to work, then bring your children in and we'll have a place where they can work on their homework. They can do their virtual school. We'll have someone there to be able to help with those types of things so that our nurses and other healthcare team members can work, can continue to work, but their children are taken care of. So I think what you, if you ask across the state, people are getting very creative with what can we do to make sure that our team members are able to come to work. And that's just one thing that we're doing here at Schneck.
Rachel, some of the clinical training is simulation based. Do you think using simulation labs is enough to prepare new nurses for what they can expect at the hospital?
We've used clinical simulation in our programs in schools of nursing in their programs for quite some time. And clinical simulation is a great tool to bolster education. But what we have to be careful of, and what I've heard from academia and others and from the practice side, is that we have to be careful because it's not the same as having or giving direct patient care. And so there is a healthy balance there of being able to produce a nurse that is able to have comfortability with the patient and ensure that they got the quality of learning required. And so in the bill, it does talk about schools of nursing, being able to increase the amount of clinical simulation. But like for an associate's degree program, that might be 500 hours. For a bachelor's, it may be 600 hours or more. And you have to think, if I could replace 50% of my clinical hours with clinical simulation, that means 250 hours in an ASM program, for example, doesn't necessarily have to be hands-on or have or require, you know, direct patient interaction. And it could be not necessarily in high fidelity simulation and high, and like in simulation labs that are very high tech and very give great experiences. It could mean that they watch something virtual on a computer screen and make decisions based on the case scenario. So really, our academic partners in that bill, it doesn't really give a lot of definition to what clinical simulation means and what the definition of clinical simulation is. And so, you know, for us in practice, that's where we deferred. And we said, we support the bill, but we're going to defer to our academic partners for them to say what the appropriate amount of clinical simulation is to provide a well-rounded student that's going to be successful in their you know, practice setting or where they choose to practice. And, you know, for hospitals, we absolutely have to have high-quality students, and we're willing to, you know, be able to be flexible, things like that, with the clinical simulation ourselves when it comes to teaching. But we really have to defer to our academic partners on what's the most appropriate balance of clinical simulation.
Amy, would you be concerned at all with 50% of a student's training happening in a simulation lab?
I'm going to echo the Rachel's response. I think what we really need to think about is, number one, making sure that when nurses are trained, they get excellent quality education. Everyone learns differently. I might be able to sit in front of a laptop and do a like a artificial intelligence type of growing scenario and learn great, but someone else may not do well with that type of scenario. There's a lot of virtual simulation now. We have a simulation lab here at our hospital with mannequins, and they're very lifelike, but they definitely are not a live patient. So I think we have to understand what are the limitations around simulation. And when we say simulation, again, the bill doesn't define it really, but when we say simulation, what does it mean? What does it entail? What would be included in that? And I think those are all questions that we need to sit down with academia and say, how can we make this work? If this is what we need in order to get more nurses, then how can we make clinical simulation, how can we build it in so that we get great quality education to these nurses and we get great nurses in the end, and we do it in a method or a way that we fast track so that we can get nurses sooner rather than later? It's a difficult conversation to have sometimes, but I think back to the time during when COVID was rampant, you know, during that time, we pulled our nurses out of healthcare facilities, because we didn't know what COVID was. We were in the middle of a pandemic trying to figure it all out early on. And we basically said, we're going to halt and we're going to stop and we're going to say, we can't have students in right now because we just don't know. We're just not sure what we're dealing with. And so a lot of those students were either delayed or they learned via simulation. And it may be such that if this bill were to go through, that we sit down and work with academia and we say, okay, if you're going to do this much simulation, then how can I, as the customer of the product that you're producing, a nurse, how can I help orient them differently? How can I change orientation to make sure that we get them that face-to-face or very hands-on work? Because we're still orienting these nurses when they come out, even though they've been through a program, it's not like we throw them to work and don't work with them and get them oriented. So what do I need to do differently? If we all sit down together, I think we can come up with this sweet spot where this much simulation is very appropriate and it meets the needs to grow nurses quicker and to grow more nurses so that we can get them in the workforce quicker.
If students were able to do simulation labs, would it help with the staff shortage of teachers?
I think that probably not, in that the only way it would help would be if you were looking at your off prime time education opportunities. So your night shift or your weekend, something like that. But having a teacher in a simulation lab with a certain number of students is still going to be the same number of students, because you still have to have a teacher there instructing, making sure they're doing it right. So I don't think that that would make a difference. I think where the difference it comes is that they don't have to be in the hospital setting as much time. Again, when you're a small rural community hospital and you only have so many patients, then you can only take so many students at the same time. So simulation would replace having to have students. It would double the number of students. It would replace them having to be in the hospital. You could have part of them in the simulation lab. You could have part of them in the hospital setting. Again, another solution that I've talked about is you could have part of them on day shift and part of them on night shift. But then you have to have, again, that double the number of faculty, which goes back to the conversation about part-time faculty.
Before we wrap up, I do want to ask, what have you seen, or have you seen any changes since we last spoke in September, Rachel?
Well, I think that what we have learned so far is that this is going to be a time where we've had to really sit back, and Amy mentioned this in the beginning, and say, what have we learned this far? What have we learned? What have we done that's worked? What have we done that's not worked? So it's really been an intense time of just really evaluation of where we've been, where we're going. How do we prepare for the future? How do we make better decisions in our emergency preparedness, et cetera? But it's really not that it's changed a lot. We've had times of highs and lows in between variants where, you know, things seem to, for a little bit, you kind of catch your breath, but it goes right back into another variant, and it's been really difficult. What I do know is I still need more people to get vaccinated. I do know that. And I, you know, really talk to people about, you know, determining what their risk is and what's best for them in this scenario. But, you know, our nurses desperately don't want to see more people with severe illness. And, you know, it is very difficult on them when we have large number of deaths in 1 week that just are not what you would normally experience. So we're still experiencing situations that just are almost humanly unfathomable at times. And so I would just say, you know, if you know a healthcare worker, tell them thank you, cook them a meal, you know, just let them know how much they mean to you and mean to your community. Let them know they're not alone and that you see them and you know they are going through a difficult time. I think that speaks more volume. It speaks, you know, louder volumes than anything else you could do right now for healthcare workers in general. But we've not seen a ton of changes, but what we are doing is we're learning and we're adapting and we're continuing to change and become more and more flexible and figuring out how to define what our next steps are. So it's, how do we put out this fire today? What are the decisions being made? Okay, let's go to the next step and taking it one step at a time. And this is definitely a marathon and hasn't been a sprint.
Rachel Spaulding is the Chief Nursing Officer at Good Samaritan Hospital in Vincennes, and Amy Pettit is the Vice President of Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at Schneck Medical Center in Seymour. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.